is his wife, because he comes back to her and he says, you know, I divorced you.
I divorced you, yes.
You can go.
Yes.
And you know what she said? She says, I was the one that told you to go. So, you know, the point is that wishy-washiness, gray area, you know, we might think that we're being very, you know, smart when we do these things. Mm. We might think that we're being very, you know, sly and you know.
I just pray that God gives us an opportunity to be like Zohair.
Right. And I think this is a problem, especially in the Muslim societies. We think that being this kind of, like, playing both sides and, you know, trying to speak out of both sides of our mouth, that this is some sort of politics or this is some sort of...
In Scotland, we say we speak out of both of our cheeks.
Right. Right. So, and yet, we see that this is not the case. There are times when it comes where you have to take a stand and say things the way they are.
Yes.
And you know, if people are going to curse you for it, they will curse you for it. Well, but Allah is praising you for it.
Of course he is.
And Imam Khomeini was a person like that.
Yes.
He taught us that. He saw it on a daily basis when there was war, when there was revolution, when there was pressure. Again, I remind the people of when, you know, Shevardnadze came as the foreign minister of
the Soviet Union.
You know, everybody telling Imam, you know, you got to wink at him and you got to, you know, be nice to him and maybe the Soviets can help us during the war and, you know, we're under pressure. Didn't put on his turban, came out with pajamas, didn't even say hi to him, and basically told him that your system is going to, you know, go to hell
in a handbasket.
And then he just got up in the middle of Shevardnadze's speech and said, I'm going to bed.
I'm going to bed.
Right? Why? Because Shevardnadze was a communist, was a person who was killing Afghans at that time, the army, the Soviets.
Yeah, Muslims, yes.
So, that's it. And Allah made us win and they lost.
Thank you, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on that note. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners, and I hope they benefited from what we've said today. And it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Hello and welcome back to the light. Loneliness can hit anyone at any time, but it becomes severe during the pandemic-like scenario the world is going through. But some Japanese are enjoying the companionship of robots to overcome loneliness as they are unable to meet their loved ones during the coronavirus. The cute singing snowman is called Charlie. He is one among a large number of new generation clever robots being produced in Japan. Manufacturers are making a wide variety of affordable androids as well as robotic pets, and they say their sales are booming. They also say their products have found favor with customers of all ages, not just kids. Studies have shown that therapeutic pets can bring comfort to dementia patients.
Spring is coming and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning sceneries across China. Clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the main university is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery after missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and the warm spring.
In other cities, it is the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white-colored blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so that they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now, Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping over staircases or lifting their guns. The unit, made up of 10 men and 10 women, would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times, it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
The coronavirus and related restrictions have forced many businesses to either close or struggle. But some people have found ways to save their jobs and help others to survive the crisis. A top German chef is the one. Peter Frusamer now prepares dishes at a hospital canteen outside Berlin. Frusamer says before accepting the job, he was the head chef at his wife's restaurant. But it was closed due to the pandemic, and he chose to be a hospital cook rather than a jobless man. This German chef says he is happy to find some distraction while working in a hospital kitchen, besides making a contribution to patients' recovery.
I find it frustrating to be here and see the empty tables and the empty restaurant. When I'm at the hospital, I don't notice any of this. For me, the coronavirus crisis doesn't exist at the hospital. Sure, corona is always a topic, but there, I'm at work and I'm busy. But when I come here, I notice what a cut is going through society. That's why I'm happy to have my hospital and to find some distraction. Here in the restaurant, I could actually sit down and start crying.
The hospital staff also seem happy with Frusamer's presence. They say since the arrival of the new chef, they come to eat in the canteen regularly and discover new dishes not eaten before. Frusamer believes the reason health workers and patients love his dishes is that he gives his heart and soul to the food.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view as a stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
For some people, it may take years to build a morning running habit. However, this very special runner seems very impatient in sticking to its daily running routine. The 2-meter-tall ostrich escaped its dwelling to run alongside vehicles on the streets of Beihai, South China. It even tried to keep up with a car's speed by jogging at a very fast pace. The bird's owner says it opened the gates of the farm it stayed in and escaped. He guided the fugitive bird back to the farm by covering his face with a red cloth. The video of the athlete ostrich went viral after its running was caught on traffic cameras.
Iran has inaugurated the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition according to health protocols. The event is aimed at injecting fresh energy into the tourism industry, which has been badly affected by COVID-19 over the past year. Saman Kujori reports.
Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has been inaugurated according to health protocols announced by the National Headquarters for Coronavirus Control. and following the necessary coordination with the relevant agencies in this field. According to organizers, visiting the exhibition in person will be controlled. Only a specific number of people are allowed to visit each day. Officials and experts believe Erevan will achieve a tourism boom after the coronavirus outbreak, believing its impact would be temporary and short-lived for a country that ranked the third fastest-growing tourism destination in 2019.
Although we were under sanctions and at the same time corona pandemic badly affected tourism industry across the country, we have developed and completed many projects in the country during this period. We are very optimistic about the future of tourism industry in Iran because we believe good days are around the corner. Iran is a historically and culturally rich country with abundant attractions.
According to the latest data, 8 million tourists visited the Islamic Republic during the first 10 months of the past Iranian calendar year. Iran ranks first globally in terms of the number of handicraft cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. The number of Iranian craft cities and villages stands at 14, while the second place goes to China, which has only 7 craft cities and villages globally registered.
Handicraft exports from Iran before the coronavirus outbreak reached $146 million in the Persian calendar year, which started in March 2019. Iraq and Persian Gulf littoral countries are among the main target markets for Iranian handicrafts.
Under the 2025 Tourism Vision Plan, the country aims to increase the number of tourist arrivals from 4.8 million in 2014 to 20 million in 2025.
Iran's tourism ministry has proposed travel packages under strict health protocols, with the hope of encouraging people to travel and injecting fresh energy to the tourism industry, especially during the upcoming Nowruz holidays. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Feeling frustrated and stressed out, Brazilians have found a place to vent their anger and fury in the newly opened Rage Room. Inside a warehouse on the outskirts of Sao Paulo, people can freely swing giant hammers at old televisions, computers and printers. Demolishing the machines and shattering glass into tiny pieces helps to release their pent-up feelings. The 42-year-old who opened the business a month ago says he has received a fair number of customers wanting to vent, especially during the pandemic.
I think it was the best moment to be able to set this up here. Related to everything that people are going through, a lot of anxiety, stress. Sometimes people miss work or even work a lot at home. I believe this here is like an escape at the moment.
Wearing protective suits and helmets, participants write issues that bother them on the walls, turning the words into targets of their anger. One might think how much it costs to break all these things up. The Rage Room experience, however, costs just less than $5.
Tens of thousands of flamingos have turned the Indian city of Navi Mumbai pink. Bird lovers gathered near a lake to watch the migrating flamingos. Every year, flamingos migrate to Navi Mumbai between October and March. They go there from northern and western parts of India and sometimes as far away as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. Then they fly out in June. This year and last year, their numbers were much higher. Experts say that is because the lake is cleaner thanks to COVID lockdowns.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the assassination of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, according to a new intelligence report that the Biden administration released on Friday, 26th of February, that offered the world a reminder of the brutal killing. The article that you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Julian Barnes, David Sanger, Mark Mazzetti, Michael Crawley, and Michael LaForgia. The piece is titled Saudi Crown Prince is Held Responsible for Khashoggi Killing in U.S. Report. Stay with us for more. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the assassination of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, according to a new intelligence report that the Biden administration released on Friday, 26th of February, that offered the world a reminder of the brutal killing. An elite team of operatives helped carry out the killing, the report said. The team reported directly to Prince Mohammed, who cultivated a climate of fear that made it unlikely for aides to act without his consent, according to the report. It omitted the brutal details of Mr. Khashoggi's death, including the dismemberment of his body with a bone saw after Saudi officials lured him to their consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. But the Biden administration took no direct action against Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, instead announcing travel and financial sanctions on other Saudi officials involved in the killing and on members of the elite unit of Royal Guard who protected the Crown Prince. The Biden administration concluded it could not risk a full rupture of its relations with the Saudi kingdom, relied on by the United States to broker peaceful relations with the Israeli regime. Cutting off Saudi Arabia could also push its leaders towards China. Lawmakers of both parties praised the release of the report, but some Democrats, including Representative Adam Schiff of California, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, spoke out in dismay that the administration stopped short of more severely punishing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for killing of Mr. Khashoggi. Khashoggi was a legal permanent resident of Virginia who was critical of the Saudi government in the columns that he wrote for the Washington Post. There are ways to bring about more personal repercussions without completely rupturing the relationship, Adam Schiff said in an interview. Adam Schiff added, "This is an official U.S. government statement that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has blood on his hands, and that blood belongs to an American resident and journalist, and I think that's very powerful." The 2018 assassination of Jamal Khashoggi and the brutality of his death, detailed in news reports at the time, shocked the world. And it disgusted American officials, including the CIA director at the time, Gina Haspel, according to current and former intelligence officials. Gina Haspel and other American officials listened to a recording obtained by Turkish intelligence that not only captured Jamal Khashoggi's struggle against Saudi agents and his killing, but also the sounds of the bone saw being used on his body. The Saudi government issued a blistering response to the report's release and the penalties, rejecting the document as a negative, false, and unacceptable assessment about its leadership. It is truly unfortunate that this report, with its unjustified and inaccurate conclusions, is issued whilst the Saudi kingdom had clearly denounced this heinous crime, the statement said. It noted that the kingdom had taken steps to prevent a repeat of the killing. It prosecuted 8 people in connection with the murder. Much of the evidence the CIA used to conclude that Prince Mohammed bin Salman was culpable in Jamal Khashoggi's killing remains classified. But the report's disclosure was the first time that the American intelligence community had made its conclusions public, and the declassified document was a powerful rebuke of the Crown Prince, a close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, whose continued support of him prompted international outrage. The release of the report signaled that President Joe Biden, unlike his predecessor, would not set aside the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, and that his administration intended to try to isolate the Saudi Crown Prince. We assess that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved an operation in Istanbul, Turkey, to capture or kill Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, said the report, issued by Mr. Biden's Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines. The decision to rebuke the Saudis without punishing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman directly was the result of a weeks-long debate among aides to President Biden, who during the 2020 presidential campaign called Saudi Arabia a pariah state with no redeeming social value. 2 years earlier, Joe Biden called out the Trump administration for its inaction after Jamal Khashoggi's death, calling it embarrassing and dangerous. President Biden's newly formed national security team advised him that he could not bar the heir to the Saudi crown from entering the United States, nor weigh criminal charges against him, without breaching the relationship with a key Arab ally, according to officials. They said that a consensus emerged inside the White House that the cost of such a breach in terms of Saudi cooperation was simply too high. For Joe Biden, the decision was a telling indication that his more cautious instincts had kicked in. In an interview with Univision on Friday, 26th of February, President Biden said that he spoke yesterday with the Saudi king and not the crown prince. Mr. Biden added that he had made it clear to him that the rules are changing and we're going to be announcing significant changes today and on Monday to hold the Saudis accountable. It is outrageous what happened. Ultimately, the Biden administration announced penalties against Saudi officials, including a travel ban and freezing of assets of the kingdom's former intelligence chief, and sanctions against members of a paramilitary unit that took part in the assassination. The U.S. State Department also announced visa restrictions against 76 Saudi nationals accused of suppressing or harming journalists, activists, and dissidents. And more will eventually be applied to others around the world as the administration expands enforcement of a new Khashoggi ban, the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said. The relationship with Saudi Arabia is bigger than any one individual, Anthony Blinken added on Friday at a news conference at the U.S. State Department. Blinken said, "What we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to calibrate it to be more in line with the interests and our values." Dennis Ross, a former Middle East negotiator and foreign policy aide in administrations of both political parties, applauded Joe Biden for trying to thread the needle, calling the matter a classic example of where you have to balance your values and your interests. "We are now doing things that show a clear difference with the previous Trump administration on democracy and human rights," Dennis Ross added. The 4-page intelligence report contained few previously undisclosed major facts and reiterated the CIA's conclusion from 2018 that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. It made its case based on smaller pieces of evidence and the CIA's understanding of the Crown Prince's control of the Saudi kingdom, which intelligence officials have long said led him to a high confidence conclusion of his culpability. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman viewed Jamal Khashoggi as a threat and broadly supported using violent measures if necessary to silence him, the intelligence report concluded. American intelligence agencies learned that Saudi officials had planned an unspecified operation against Mr. Khashoggi, but the report said the United States has not learned when the Saudi officials decided to harm him. Members of the HIT team flew to Turkey on 2nd of October 2018 after Saudi officials lured Jamal Khashoggi, who was seeking paperwork to marry his Turkish fiancée, into the consulate building in Istanbul. While the team arrived in Istanbul prepared to kill Jamal Khashoggi, American intelligence agencies were not confident that was their only authorized option. The spy agencies could not rule out that Prince Mohammed bin Salman might have preferred to capture Mr. Khashoggi, an American intelligence official said, adding that the CIA and other intelligence agencies have high confidence in their judgment that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for an order to either capture or kill Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi's body was never found. According to the report, Prince Mohammed fostered an environment where his aides feared that any failure to follow his orders could result in their arrest. This suggests that the aides were unlikely to question Mohammed bin Salman's orders or undertake sensitive action without his consent, the report said. The report listed 21 individuals involved in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, including members of a HIT team. The operatives worked for the Saudi Center for Studies and Media Affairs, at the time led by Saud al-Qahtani, a close advisor of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Mr. Al-Qahtani's official job was the media czar for the royal court, and he was once in charge of the campaign to use social media to attack Saudi dissidents online. The report noted that Mr. Al-Qahtani had said publicly that he did not make decisions without the Crown Prince's approval. The report said that 7 members of Prince Mohammed bin Salman's elite protective detail, called the Rapid Intervention Force, or RIF, were part of the 15-man team that murdered Jamal Khashoggi. The unit has carried out a campaign of kidnapping, surveillance, detention, and torture to crush opposition to the Saudi royal family. Members of the RIF, or the Rapid Intervention Force, would not have participated in the operation against Khashoggi without Mohammed bin Salman's approval, the declassified report said. From the moment Mr. Khashoggi's death was discovered, Saudi officials sought to deflect blame from the Crown Prince. The Saudi government imprisoned 8 people in connection with Mr. Khashoggi's death, trying them largely secretively. Though 5 were originally sentenced to death, after one of Mr. Khashoggi's sons said he and his siblings had forgiven the men who had killed their father, a Saudi court reduced the sentences to prison terms. Adam Schiff, the Democratic representative from California, said he met with White House officials on Friday, 26th of February, to press for more personal repercussions on the Saudi Crown Prince. "I don't think the president should be meeting with him. I don't think the president should be talking with him," Mr. Schiff said. "I think the administration should explore ways to go after assets that he controls." Ahead of the report's release, President Joe Biden spoke to King Salman of Saudi Arabia, and officials have said President Biden will speak only with the king, his counterpart as head of state, though others in the administration might speak directly to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Representative Tom Malinowski, a Democrat from New Jersey, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the Obama administration, said a visa ban for Mohammed bin Salman should be mandatory under existing law if the Secretary of State has credible information that he committed a gross human rights abuse, which the Secretary of the State just told us that he has. aperture.
Detroit was once the city of the American dream and the success of the automotive industry. It was regarded as the engine of America's automotive industry. With over 2 million inhabitants in the 50s, Detroit was one of the richest cities in the world. Thanks to its triumph came the middle class, but the American dream did not last for long, and slowly things started to fall apart.
I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture.
With the collapse of Detroit's industrial hegemony, unemployment and deterioration spiraled out of control. On the verge of bankruptcy, this once thriving metropolitan is now a ghost town. The population has halved to about 700,000 people, and everywhere in the city, there are large areas affected by the abandonment. Hundreds and thousands of homes, schools, churches, and shops are in ruins, giving the city an eerie feeling. Stay with us as this week's program follows several individuals left in Detroit trying to make sense out of the chaos.
Detroit was industry. And at the beginning of the 20th century, industry was king. So car obviously changed everything. I mean, the assembly line was invented here. It changed the way that manufacturing was done. Then you had streetlights. You had paved roads. You know, all of these things started here. They spread out. So in a lot of ways, Detroit changed the world. And with all of these factories, with all of these jobs, these people that were making a living wage, you know, the middle class was invented in Detroit. So with all of this fortune came grandeur, beautiful buildings, beautiful movie theaters and office buildings. You know, Detroit really kind of, it was a cosmopolitan place. As the American automobile was really the only game in town, things were great. And then as foreign makes started happening, as outsourcing of jobs started bleeding the city of its population, things started to go downhill.
This is the living out of the American dream, which has run its course and has now seen defeat. Unfortunately, we climbed a credit mountain, and now we sit inside the shell of the debt that it created. We have a lot of empty houses, a lot of empty streets, just entire sections of the city that are sparsely, very sparsely populated. It's kind of buckling at the knees and toppling, and it's a mess.
Don't understand what it means to be a representative of the people and be in the city council. And I keep hearing things like, well, I'm going to vote according to what I think is best for the people. I keep hearing that word, I think, is best for the people. Have you talked to the people? The people are sitting in the room. They're selling no.
I had lost a house already. I couldn't refinance it, and so it had to get foreclosed on. That was back in 2006.
When I got booted out of the corporate job that I had, and I looked at the corporate world, and I said, this is really messed up. I mean, I know that my life is out to make a difference, and I looked for where was that difference going to hit. And I knew that this movement was going to be something that has a foothold, it has the opportunity to make a difference. When you become activist, there's something about it. There's something about having hope for and fighting for a future. Breeds life. You ask the question why, like a 3-year-old asks. And so every day is a discovery process. I am going to do something. Now what I'm going to do has to be defined. But I do know that the objective is to make the city available to the people.
Jennifer's story. I said, Jennifer's a woman. She's struggling with foreclosure. So many people said to me, yeah, we're all struggling with foreclosure. Even if you're personally not facing foreclosure, maybe your neighbor is, maybe you got an empty house on your block that's a blight, you know what I mean, that lowers your property value, that's dangerous. And if this is a thing that affects everybody, and it's really nice to see everybody get involved to fight it, because this doesn't help anybody. Evicting a person like Jennifer and her family doesn't help anybody. So I'm just going to turn the mic over to Jennifer. She's going to say a few words. All right, thank you very much.
First of all, let me say thank you for coming out.
When the judge signs the writ of eviction, they're going to assign a dumpster to be set in front of my home, and from that point, I have 24 hours to vacate the premises with all of my belongings, or the bailiffs will come out, go into my home, and take everything I have and throw it into that dumpster.
Oh, my goodness.
The plan is that with the support that I have from my community and from Occupy Detroit, that they will block that from happening. They will block that dumpster from being set down when that all happens. And if they can keep it from being set down, then that will give us more time to try and work things out with the bank.
A lot of the home eviction situations, if we're dealing with people who've had a hardship in their life, because Jennifer, her house was in her husband's name, and her husband passed, and she was not listed on the house. And she's sitting here making payments every month, so the payments are coming in for the house. But she's not listed as the owner on the house. So you have to wonder, is the bank, taking them out of town? Are they just collecting payments and then saying, well, this doesn't match with the house, but thank you for all these payments? If she takes it to court, she's acting in good faith. And the question is, can the bank act in good faith in return?
I'm here in the home with me and my husband's two children, my mother and my uncle, who is mentally ill since birth. And, you know, we're living here comfortably. They're going to have to drag me out because I'm not going to go out freely. I'm not doing it.
What everybody hears is how violent Detroit is and how high the crime and so forth is. But I really, really like Detroit. And, you know, I don't have any plans of ever leaving Detroit, even with what I'm going through or whatever. I mean, I really like Detroit a lot.
And I think it has a great potential to come back. You know, it's suffering right now, but I think it has a great potential to come back.
Population started to decline around 1950, so this is not a new phenomenon. It's not something that happened overnight.
There's 4-7. Another 33 to go.
But as the city continued to bottomed out. And we hit rock bottom, more or less. Skyscrapers started going dark. Hotels closed.
So after that 40-foot climb, in which I'm nearly dead, you're rewarded with one of the most amazing views of the city. And you can get a feel for just how majestic Detroit was and still is. Detroit, this tall tower off there in the distance, Detroit extends like another 5 miles past that, you know? I mean, it's like the city is just huge and it's too big. And it goes as far as you can see, basically. So the city, back in the 1950s, we had 2 million people, and we had a tax base of 2 million people supporting a city of this size. But one of our biggest problems now is that Detroit doesn't have 2 million people. We have 770,000 people, but we're supporting the same size city. So while it takes the same number of cops to patrol the same number of square miles, we don't have the same number of people paying for those cops. I mean, to give you an idea, you can fit Boston, Manhattan, and San Francisco combined within the city limits of Detroit and still have room left over. I mean, Manhattan has five times as many people as Detroit alone. So, I mean, this is technically a city that is big enough geographically to support like 10 million people.
When people are cast out of their homes, they're not sure where they're going next. I mean, I've sat in this situation myself. I've been fortunate in that I have a network of people. I talked about, or you stay with this friend and you find a place to stay for a while. And you can only count on support for as long as support works. Then you have to go to the next thing and the next thing. And you may wind up exhausting your options at some point in time. It just may be, I don't know where to go next.
I'm single, I'm by myself, I live down here. It's way safer than if I was by myself under an overpass somewhere.
When I first was homeless, I had a car, you know, and then eventually shit happens where you don't have a car anymore, and it's a gradual process, but I think, yeah, when I didn't have a place to take a shower every day, that's when I was like, damn, this sucks.
I'm from Detroit. I used to live in Detroit when I was a child. My family is originally from Detroit. And actually, my great-grandma was born in Detroit, late 1880s, late 1890s, before the automobile. So, yeah, my family definitely goes back to Detroit. But, it just kind of fell apart, you know. Detroit, I still love Detroit. You know, it's just sad.
We're in the Lee Plaza Hotel. The Plaza was built in the late 1920s, closed in 1997. For the last 40 years of its life or so, it was a senior housing facility. But this gives you a taste of the grandeur of Detroit in the 1920s, and like so much of Detroit, it's just been left to rot, exposed to the elements, water licking away the plaster. It's one of those places in Detroit that you see paradise lost. To figure out how to blaze a new path. Are we going to continue living in the past? Are we going to change the way that we do things? Are we going to, you know, just continue to make the same mistakes that we have made over and over and over again?
what happens in Detroit when houses get abandoned is that people come through. You have kids that are vandalizing, breaking windows for fun and things like that. But then you also have scrappers who are coming through and ripping out the wiring and the pipes to recycle the metal and get money for that. So when you enter an abandoned house, and I can even show you some of these that have not been cleaned out yet, they're in shambles, and also many times there's a lot of artifacts from the family who lived there, books and clothes and pots and pans, and it's a very eerie thing. It's like people just are gone. First thing we did was patch up the windows of this house because the windows were completely busted out. We did dumpster diving at the recycle centers and got all these wine bottles. Mainly what we have here are people who are exiting industrial society. A lot of the people here are artists, and they want to have time to develop their art, and they want to live with their own rhythms and not have to wake up an alarm clock and worry about bills and things like that. So this lifestyle, you can do that, and it is a lot like a rural lifestyle. It's a lot like being out in the country out here, and it's in the city.
This used to be the site of Peck Elementary School. So in front of me back here was the school, and we're standing on what was the playground, right on the baseball diamond right here. So we've turned it into a really big vegetable garden right now. We're growing garlic and garlic scapes, sugar snap peas, carrots. Behind me in the hoop house here, we've got lots and lots of tomatoes for the summer, some peppers and eggplants, and we're branching into growing all kinds of things besides just vegetables too. For me, it just kind of puts together a lot of things, solving so many of the problems that we have. There's the problem of all this vacant space in the city that's unused. There's the jobs problem, where half the people in the city can't find sufficient work. There's the problem of our food system, where people shop at party stores and buy packaged, unhealthy food. Detroit doesn't have any major supermarkets. There are smaller supermarkets. A problem for so many Detroiters, though, is they don't have transportation even to those. When we were planting our orchard out here, a neighbor went by, an older woman, who was walking miles up to Highland Park with a cart in order to go to a grocery store, because there's nothing in this neighborhood. And if you go to a corner store, a party store, they have chips and soda and pretzels and hot buns. Not the kind of thing you can cook with or feed a family with or stay healthy with.
Yeah, this is the newest part of our addition to the garden, and we just started this maybe 6 months ago. Most of the produce we grow out of here is our cash crops, like our basil and onion, paste, parsley. As you can see, we carefully take care of our babies. We come out here in the morning, we pray over it, and we water it just about every day. So it's really good, man. I mean, it's just a wonder to see things come from a little bitty seedling to something that you can actually eat. So. Yeah, so, I mean, like, it's just a group of individuals, man, who really believe in our city, who believe in the thriving newness, and so we just took an effort to reclaim something that nobody wanted to do or just was going to burn up or tear up. And so this is our landscape. It's like our own little Home Depot.
This is the crest of the
sort of industrial, modern consumer society. And it was the crest of the decline of that in the 70s. That's when my family left Detroit. So, and I also see this as the crest of what's coming forward. You know, this is the birthplace of techno music. And what is the post-industrial society going to be? I feel Detroit is going to be an important part of that conversation. And that's why I'm here. And I feel that also the people here in this community are saying, okay, how are we going to do this?
People say Detroit's like the Wild West because people just do what they want and what they have to in this city. We're really going outside of city planning and city governance out here. There's no allowance right now for urban agriculture, and the city's been spending years and years and years trying to do it. So everyone who's farming in this city has just decided to do it on their own without waiting for somebody to okay it. And I'm somebody who is better at just getting things done than trying to get other people to do things.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, attaches a great deal of significance to education among workers. He says, in the current world and with the speedy technological developments, constant education and training and using the previous experience is a necessity for productive and working institutions so that economic prosperity increases through strengthening of productivity and quality of production. Please stay with us with a new program in our series, Second Phase of the Revolution, Leap in Production. Stay with us. Academic studies on successful economic models show that development occurs in societies in which, in addition to natural resources and material assets, there are notable human resources too. In other words, the countries that have achieved higher economic growth have better education, better skilled workers, and a more efficient workforce. The top parameter in development of any country is its manpower, which has a remarkable share in the economic, social, and cultural development of the country. Studies on development reveal that government policies, including investment on human resource development and expenses of research and development, have not only been effective on growth and productivity, but also on appropriate distribution of income and reduction of economic inequality. In the postmodern era, human asset is the greatest and most valuable property of every organization and every country. Accordingly, investment in this field, especially in the domain of innovative sciences relating to cyberspace and artificial intelligence, is a strategic necessity due to the fact that these two factors set the ground for exponential growth of production. In view of this, many researchers and experts of management and productivity maintain that a country's access to high level of productivity depends on having organizations and factories that enjoy adequate competitiveness, profitability, and creation of high added value. To create such organizations, it is essential to have skilled workforce and productive personnel. Human asset, in fact, demonstrates the know-how in the minds and thoughts of the personnel, and it is the basic source of innovation and regeneration of an organization introduces a combination of qualifications, attitude, and creativity of its personnel. Today, the role and importance of manpower is a yardstick in gauging production and offering services. In view of this, human asset or human personnel has gained higher share so that it has created the concept of know-how economy in production of gross domestic product or GDP. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's emphasis on leap in production and manufacturing during the era of maximum sanctions outlines a pleasant perspective of Iran's economy. The only way to exit from current economic woes is to fix the eyes on the interior and use the domestic capacities and capabilities in a synergy of skilled and specialist workforce. Human assets can both transform themselves and develop to modify other parameters. This will result in a permanent, dynamic economy. Alvin Toffler, a pioneer of change and development, says know-how and technology are the key to economic growth. Many countries have attained an important status in the global economy through planning and reliance on domestic resources and implementation of long-term projects based on know-how and technology. Statistics show that Iran ranks third in terms of manpower development. As for economic development, Iran has had a good economic growth, which is manifested in the fields of nanotechnology and knowledge-based companies. Development of technical and professional training plays a vital role in the current state of Iran's economy, because the country's infrastructural investment and increase of tools and equipment without an efficient human workforce will be useless or will be used ineffectively. Technical and professional training requires both development and a mix of know-how, skills, and creativity, particularly among a young workforce, the educated youth. Thus, technical and professional universities play a significant role in teaching the necessary skills for the workforce needed in industry, agriculture, and the service sector. Today, these universities have a capacity to educate nearly 150,000 students at 174 universities and higher institutions and academic centers. Targeted training of skills as a national strategy plays a key role in achieving economic success, social welfare,